In case you decide to throw it in there somewhere, because it would make my kid's day, but you don't have to. But Edith Boget says hi, and then you are awesome.
Well, thank you,
Edith. They actually listen to you sometimes over my own advice.
You should probably listen to your dad. I think he probably has more knowledge than me, but that is awesome. So hello, Edith. And welcome back to the Exotic Pet Collective. My name is Richard, and thank you so much for joining me for yet another episode. Today, we've got some exciting guests. And yes, that is plural, because we are talking to the entire pet bug department of Josh's Frogs. They give us a peek behind the curtain, everything from breeding and packing and caring for all of these amazing arachnids and invertebrates that they have there, as well as just kind of a general overview of the entire business that is Josh's Frogs. So it was a very interesting conversation. I think you're really going to enjoy it. But before we jump right into the podcast, I do want to make one announcement. You do still have time to enter the Holloway fundraiser giveaway for Harmony House. Just head over to my YouTube channel, Tarantula Collective. Look for the Halloween fundraiser video. I'll also have link down in the show notes in the description of this podcast. And just watch that short video. And there's three different ways to enter. So, you know, you just check that out. Choose one or all three of the different ways to enter. I mean, just watch the video. You'll find out all the different ways to enter. But at any rate, please check that out. Our goal is $10,000, and we're so close. Last time I checked, we had just crossed $8,000 on the GoFundMe fundraiser. So it's really exciting. I think we're going to do this. You have until the end of the month. I'll be doing a live stream, I believe either the 29th or the 30th. On my main YouTube channel, and we'll be drawing all the winners there. But that's not why you guys tuned in. You're not here to listen to me talk. You want to know about what's going on at Josh's Frogs and their pet bug department. So we're just going to jump straight into it today. Let's go. All right, so let's welcome to the podcast the Pet Bugs Division of Josh's Frogs. Hello, everyone. How are you all? Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, so I guess the best way to start off is just kind of introduce yourselves to everybody listening. Shay, you want to kick that off?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Shay. I work here at the Pet Bugs Division at Josh's Frogs. I've been in the tarantula hobby about 10 years. I started off my first tarantula. I got it from a pet store. It was little male rose hair. Had him for a couple years, and since then I've been hooked on it. Now I get to live out my dream feeding thousands of spiders every week.
Oh, that is awesome. Do you think, I always wondered if there's something about the tarantula hobby and people with red hair. Like I've seen like a higher percentage of redheads in the tarantula hobby than I have like in any other social group I've ever been in. I'll
add two adjectives to that, Richard. I've noticed that these redheads that are so common also tend to be small and dangerous.
I think most redheads are small and dangerous. Oh, but that's very awesome. Shay, Austin, what about you?
I'm Austin. I'm part of the Josh's Frogs Pet Bugs team. I've been in the tarantula hobby about 4 years. I got started. Someone just gave me a spider and it was down the rabbit hole immediately.
Oh, very cool. And what about you, Jason?
Well, believe it or not, 22 years ago, I started working at this pet store called Pruce's Pets. And I was so uncomfortable around tarantulas, I didn't even want to change the waters in the rose hair tanks. 22 years later, and I built that pet store to have the biggest in-store collection of any pet store in Michigan. Did all sorts of fun tarantula nights. 3 years ago, I joined this team, became part of the tarantula breeding project here at Josh's Frogs, and now we're looking to see what we can build.
Very cool. So 22 years ago, that's about the same time I got my start. So we must be
nice.
Around the same age.
I'm 49.
Not at all. I'm just kidding. Yeah, I'm a little bit younger than you. I just turned 40. But yeah, I was about... Enjoy it. I'm already falling apart, my friend.
It just gets worse from here.
I noticed that this year. I'm just like, I'm so tired all the time. But what this is something that I've kind of never really been clear on is where exactly is Josh's Frogs located?
Owosso, Michigan. It's not too far off from Flint, and it's just kind of an old warehouse that used to be a casket factory.
Okay, and Flint is kind of near Detroit, right?
It's about an hour and a half from Detroit.
Okay. I don't know Michigan at all. So what's the name of the town again?
Owosso.
Owosso. Okay.
Yep. We're about just over half an hour outside of Lansing, Michigan.
Okay. Right on. I know Ann Arbor and Detroit. I think it's about the only places I've ever been as far as, well, I mean, I've driven through Michigan a few times, but so it's just like a big warehouse facility, or does it have like a storefront that people can visit?
Nope. We are online only. The only way we really get to connect with our customers is through our social media interactions and the trade shows that we do. And we often go to trade shows up to 2-3 a weekend. So that's a pretty cool opportunity that they present us as well.
So you're going to 2 or 3 expos every weekend? How does that work?
We just kind of sign up and whoever gets picked goes. And so then the company flies us around and we go vend some super cool shows.
Very cool.
I'd like to point out that that's the greater Josh's Frogs team. We're a company with a little bit over 100 employees, so that we're sending different people to different shows. Austin, what was the last show that you went to?
Vegas, the Las Vegas Super Show.
Wow. And Shay, what's the next show that you're going to be going to?
I will be in Rochester, New York, the beginning of November.
So when you go to these shows, like how, if you're flying there, how do you, are you bringing animals with you or how does that work?
We use FedEx.
It depends on the type of show. We have two different types of shows that we go to. One is within driving distance, and we have a big trailer that we load up. And, you know, a large part of what we do here at Josh's Frogs is knowing how to properly pack exotic pecs to survive the shipping process. But then when we go to flying shows, we send those overnight. We send our employees out the planes. They get there. They go to the FedEx drop-off point. They pick it up. They go to the shows. They set up. When they're done, what they haven't sold, they pack back up, put back in FedEx. It gets mailed, they get flown, and we all do it over again the next week.
So how long has Josh's Frogs had a pet bug department? Because I feel like it hasn't been that long, at least that I've been aware of it.
It actually started just a month or two before I got hired. I've known Josh Willard for 22 years since he was selling fruit flies out of his basement. And I was told to give me a ring when he starts breeding arthropods. Then I found out that he had already, so I applied. It was just me and one other young lady at first. Unfortunately, I lost her, and I've gained a few great people along the way that I've lost, but now it's Shay and I, and right now we're wrangling the spiders.
So when it comes to the tarantulas and other invertebrates and stuff that you guys carry, are they all captive bred? Like, do you do all the breeding in-house? Are you importing them, or like, how does all that work?
I'd love to talk about that for a moment. For Josh's Frogs, we absolutely hang our hat on the captive bred thing. We don't judge other people if they're not selling captive bred, but it's part of our mission to be able to replace the supply of wild-caught imported animals of all sorts with their captive bred equivalents. So we only sell captive bred spiders. I have a few breeder stock that I'll occasionally downsell or downsize. But I have started with a few F0 breeder stocks, but we're so big about the captive bred importance that we don't sell the breeder stock that we let go that is not captive bred. We wind up rehoming those with friends or relatives.
Gotcha. I mean, there are like other breeders across the United States. There are captive breeders like throughout Europe and stuff. I mean, do you ever, you know, buy wholesale from these other breeders to sell, or is it all in-house?
Gotcha. Well, our goal is to be mostly in-house, but we're starting out and building up. So currently, besides our own stock, we are buying in some of our spiders. One of our favorite ways to do that is for the individual hobbyist who's just having a great time and just decided to breed their own particular spider. They don't have the wherewithal resources to move those, but it's still a fun part of the hobby. And we can be helpful with that by buying and reselling. But our goal is to eventually be producing the vast majority of ours.
Gotcha. Now, I know one thing, you know, some other tarantula dealers out there do, which is something I like to take advantage of from time to time, is like in my personal collection, I'll have a tarantula that I've raised up from a spiderling, and it's turned in, it's molted out male. So I've got a mature male. I'm not doing any breeding. I don't want to do any breeding. And I don't know anyone close by that's interested in doing breeding. So sometimes I'll reach out to different dealers and stuff, see if they're looking for a male for their own breeding projects. And you know, you set up some kind of arrangement there, whether they just buy it or we do a trade or something like that. Do you guys deal with that at all? Or, I mean, like, do you buy males for breeding or do you like, how does that work? I guess is what I'm trying to get at.
Shay, you want to take that one?
Yeah. So we've done 50-50s in the past where we work out, you know, deals with whoever we're getting this mail from. We have bought out males from people before to put in our breeding program. It kind of just depends on the female to male ratio we have at the time, depending on like what priority that is. We do have kind of like an agreement just to cover our butts since it's a pretty big business. But overall, it's the same standard. Just, you know, be respectful with us. Stuff happens when they're males, whether they die of old age, whether they get eaten in the breeding process. We have protocol to try to prevent that, obviously. But yeah, 50-50s is absolutely something we do. We haven't done much recently, but it's something that we're always open to talk about.
Personally, I hate 50-50 arrangements. Anytime somebody offers that, I'm like, no, thank you. Like, you keep the spiderlings.
I would like to actually add to that. Shay is 100% right in what she said, but I do have a preference, like you said. When there are 50-50 arrangements, there can be challenges. You know, it's never a guaranteed thing, and not everybody understands that. So we'd much rather buy males coming in than 50-50, though, anytime.
Yeah. I mean, just from my perspective, it seems like that makes a lot more sense. Just because, I mean, a lot of, like, you breed an LP, you get 1,000 spiderlings. What am I going to do with 500 spiderlings in a 50-50 split, you know? I'm always very hesitant doing that. And I always get worried when I see people online, especially a new keeper, and it's like their first male and they send it out for a 50-50 split. I'm like, what? You don't realize what you're getting into. Like, they send all those spiderlings back. That's a lot of effort and time. Speaking of that.
And that's the best case scenario. That's the best case scenario. Yeah. A lot of times they don't understand the risks involved. I just had a friend of mine took a HMAC on 50-50 and her female marked him right away. She didn't have a chance to get in there at all. And he was not very understanding.
Yeah. I got frustrated. I think the first few times I sent out males for breeding, it was just like other people in the hobby. And it happened like 2 or 3 times in a row, the male got eaten during the breeding process. And in my mind, I started thinking like, I think I'm getting scammed. I'm getting ripped off. These people are just saying it got eaten. And, you know, months later, they've got a successful sack. And you never really know, well, was that my male that produced that sack? Or did you get another male the next week? Or, you know, how did that work? So I just stopped doing that altogether. Yeah. And I think some people, they just don't understand the time frame. You know, like I bred my Mexican red rump tarantula. And it was like 4 months before she dropped an egg sac. You know, 3 or 4 months. And I think some people have that idea that it's going to be like within a few weeks. You know, if they don't hear back from you within a month, they start to get a little upset. So, I mean, that's something I personally always try to avoid.
I would say, thankfully, we practice pretty open books here. So if anything were to happen, we actually reach out regularly saying like, hey, here's a picture of your animal. This is how it's doing. Here's how it's being cared for. And if it happens that they don't want to keep part of their egg sac, we'll buy it out from them. We'll gladly keep the babies.
That does help out a lot. But a flip side of that I'd like to point out is that an ethical breeder can wind up backing himself into a difficult corner. When I first joined the team, against my advice, we took a 50-50 on Gramostola pulchra. And the problem is that was 3 years ago. And 6 months ago, it finally molted. It never produced a sac. The male was long gone, but I couldn't pair him with anybody else until it molted without giving away both halves of a sac. And then I'm not in it at all.
Yeah, I understand.
So we had to wait all that time before we could pair her with anybody else.
Yeah, I think that's one of those aspects of the tarantula business side of things that I think a lot of keepers like myself, I mean, I've made myself aware of it over the years, but I think in general, a lot of people don't know that, you know, those kind of like what's going on in the background with tarantula dealers and breeders and things like that. And I think part of that is just because it's been so secretive, I think, or people just weren't open about it for a long time. But like going to some facilities where they're doing breeding and just seeing the mass amount of spiders that they have in their care, whether they're, you know, breeding stock or their spiderlings that they have available for sale or just, you know, spiderlings that they're holding on to. It's overwhelming. Like I would walk in there and just be overwhelmed at the thought of having to feed all of those spiders. So I was curious, like, I mean, how many, like at any given time, do you guys have like a rough estimate of how many spiders you have and how do you go about making sure everybody gets fed and take care of?
So I actually keep track of all of that. I do our inventory process and kind of we work together on the census program, which the census is all of our adults and every species has a code. And that code is a number. So it'd be, for example, TAPCUP 001F. So that's Tapicinius capreus, the first one that we got, and it's a female. And so that's how we kind of keep track of our adults. And if it happens to pass away, we send an email like, okay, this was the reason of death or what we suspect to be the reason. And then we kind of take it out the census. As for babies, I go through weekly and I count them and we kind of split them up. So as of right now, it is just Jason and myself who like feed them every week. We do feed them once a week. That's kind of our standard. And we split it on what we think is even. So
yeah,
just kind of runs with that. I think I hold the record right now of doing 1400 babies in an 8-hour shift.
Wow. You fed 1400 hungry spiderlings.
Yep.
So what do you guys use as your main feeders? I mean, are you using crickets, roaches? I mean, what do you have a preference?
Crickets and fruit flies usually, depending on the size of the animals, what we vary that off of. So we have four different sizes of crickets that we use. So that varies from juvenile to adult. We do have like the little quarters in case some babies need something more than some fruit flies. But otherwise, if they're really, really small, Lanigaster fruit flies, kind of size it up, Heidi eye fruit flies.
I'd like to add to that, they were temporarily off of one of our preferred foods. While we do produce literally hundreds of thousands of Dubia roaches every week, we sell hundreds and thousands of Dubia roaches every week. So I'm letting them build that up before I go back to feeding roaches instead of crickets.
And when you say you send out an email, who are you emailing? Like just the rest of the team? Oh, okay.
Saying that email or it doesn't count.
Gotcha. Got to have that written record.
Yes. Or it's impossible to keep up with. There's just too many.
Yeah.
How many do we have, Shay? How many babies?
As of right now, we are sitting around 1,300 spiderlings and around 400 to 500 adults. And it's just the two of us.
That seems overwhelming.
It can be. A little
bit. That's why we want to have our third member back.
I'm blushing.
I think as it sits currently, I have about 280 adults in my care and about 600 spiderlings. And Jason has close to 100 adults and about 700 spiderlings.
So if you're spending eight or however many, I don't know how long your days are, but a full day at work taking care of tarantulas, when you get home, are you sick of tarantulas? Like, do you have your own, you know, pets at home? Or are you like so tired of dealing with tarantulas by the time you're off work? You know, you just want to come home to some peace and quiet.
No, I think we all actually keep some at home. I'm more of like the amble pigeon person. I have three or four of those at home right now. And I've kind of veered from tarantulas at home just because of how many I did do at work. But I have kept them at home pretty often as well.
I had a fairly epic collection that went across the board because I worked at the reptile, amphibian, small animal department at a exotic pet store. My basement at one point in time had, it was like 12 snakes, 13 geckos, four different breeding poison frog tanks, over 80 tarantulas. But between my family at home and my work, I was already overwhelmed and I already have a fairly elite collection to play with here. So I wound up selling everything off except for my my kid spider.
How about you, Austin?
So I keep just about everything. I have hundreds of spiders and I did in the beginning think that I would get very tired of taking care of them at work and at home, but I just think it's so rewarding to see everything grow. I could never take a break from it at home, honestly.
How long have you been keeping, Austin? Like, how long did you get your first tarantula?
4 years ago, one of my buddies just came to my house and dropped it off, said he couldn't keep it anymore. And it was H. chilensis. It was super, super cute spider. She was a doll.
Yeah.
And I ended up getting like 16 more 2 days later from a guy like 20 minutes away from me. It was immediate obsession.
Yeah. I'm sure you just upset a whole lot of people listening that you were just gifted a homeoma chilensis. That is, I mean, most people are out there ready to sell their mother to get one of those.
I'm still looking for one right now.
Yeah. I had one for many years. Those things take forever to grow. And he ended up being a male and I sold him to a breeder. And was hoping to get some spiderlings, but so far we have had no luck. But it wasn't a 50-50. It was I'll pay you for this and I'll send you a couple spiderlings once the sack is hatched. But well, that's awesome. You know, one thing I was really impressed following Josh's Frogs on Instagram, and I know this is like the business as a whole. I'm going to assume it was Josh. I don't really remember. But it was like kind of like a live stream on Instagram or something. And they were walking through the facility and it seemed like, between each room, there was, and I'm sure I'm going to mess this up, but there was like some kind of kind of like when you're going into a cave and you have to walk across this like pad of, you know, soapy water to make sure you're not bringing any funguses or bacterias or anything like that in or out to spread disease. You guys kind of had that like quarantine zones in between. Is that like, do you guys have something similar like that for the arachnid rooms, or is that mainly just for reptiles and amphibians?
I think everywhere has their own specific standards of what we want to keep our animals safe. And so depending on the animal, it does vary. So in our reptile rooms and like amphibian rooms, we do have the protocol. So you're not, you know, we have quarantine areas, and then we have the protocol where you have to step into like the water base before you walk through rooms. And for us in arachnids here, we have a quarantine process where anything we get in has to go through a 2-week period to make sure it's healthy, safe, doesn't have mites. It gets thoroughly inspected before it is introduced to anything else that we have.
I was kind of wondering what some of the health risks that you guys face in the pet bug department, like, you know, nematodes, mites, things of that nature. Like, what is it that you're the most concerned about, and, you know, the most, I can't think of a good way of describing it, but you strive to make sure you're protecting them.
The threats that we're guarding against that are most common are mites are going to be the most common because they're the easiest to pass surreptitiously. But they're the various syndromes that display the symptom of DKS, whether it's bacterial, fungal, toxin. I think it's actually several things that give those, but we want to keep any of that out of our system because we've learned the hard way many, many years ago. Once it's in, it's almost impossible to get out. And that's why biosecurity is such a large part of what we do.
Biosecurity. That was the phrase I think they used. I was struggling to find. I like that. So what kind of steps do you guys take? Like, say you're keeping thousands of spiders in there and different pet bugs. So is there like specific types of enclosures that you use, specific type of substrate? Like what exactly is your, like, how do you maintain a healthy population of animals that's that immense?
So we take it very, very serious. We go through a very, very in-depth process of looking over the spider. We also separate them from the rest of the spiderlings or adults we have. I personally just got in a T. vagans, so red rump tarantula, a mature male from someone we didn't really know too well. I took the spider, tubbed it, gave it a very, very, very intensive overlook, checked the underside, checked the butt, checked for impaction, any mites that may be near the pedipalps or near the chelicerae, nematodes near the mouth. And then we'll keep it in that quarantine area for quite some time. When we notice that the spider is good, we'll move it back.
So is there like specific behaviors that you're looking for to signify the tarantula is healthy or not healthy?
Yes, absolutely. And actually, behaviors are one of the very few things that you can use to judge a tarantula's health. Other than the size of the abdomen and the ability to move around, a silk tarantula is going to look very much like a healthy tarantula. However, it's not going to adapt to its new environment well. It's not going to find a place to hide. It's not going to seek out moisture. It's not going to seek out food. So if it's not eating, if it's sitting out in the open without any cover, if it's displaying symptoms of dehydration where the legs are starting to pull in because they don't have enough pressure to push out, those are the things that we're looking at for signs of a spider that I wouldn't say is sick, but isn't adapting well. And then once we figure out that it's not adapting well, we try to figure out why.
So say you've got a tarantula, you've noticed that there's like a mite infestation or, you know, nematodes or something like that. How do you go about, I mean, it's obviously in quarantine, but how do you rid them of, you know, those issues?
We honestly try to catch it immediately. We had one situation where we got in Armenia babies and they were covered. And so immediately we wiped down all the areas we were working on them with, you know, took them out of the room and contacted the person that we got them from and was like, hey, this ain't it, bud.
Yeah.
And that is the majority of where we're doing our protection is as animals are coming into our collection. But sometimes things pop up and you have to figure out what to do. And that's first you have to identify the problem and then you have to figure out how to solve it. Luckily, we have an in-house entomologist, Logan Hope. He's a manager of the arthropod production department. An example is we got some Heterometrus salinus that were bred in-house, and then we noticed what seemed to be mites. But they weren't normal. They weren't around the mouth. They weren't in the joints. They're along the side of the leg. So first thing we did is we got it to Logan. Logan managed to take a good look and identify the bug. They were actually not predatory mites. They were making use of the animal in hostile situations. So we moved them to a separate environment and we dried out the environment. The mites fell off because they weren't feeding on them. They didn't have any food and they were gone that way. Mites can be very difficult to treat because most of the things that'll harm the mite will harm the spider.
Yeah. I know that's a issue that I've dealt with years ago, was just trying to figure out what to do with this. I had a couple of tarantulas.
Stan Schultz actually had a solution for that. Stan Schultz, the author of the Tarantula Keeper's Guidebook, said, really, it becomes a race to death. You're using the cube square law in your favor. The mite has a smaller body, which has a smaller amount of moisture. The spider has a larger body, which has more moisture and can sustain desiccation for longer. So basically, you try to kill them by dehydration and hope the mites die before the spider.
Yeah, it's essentially what I had to do in that situation. Just stick it into a very dry enclosure and see what happens.
Hope it molts and yoink the spider before the mites get to it.
As for the substrate you were talking about, we have all of that made in-house. We have a whole production team that handles that for us, so we know that it's coming from a safe spot. And if we need to, you know, we'll bake it or get it where it needs to be just to take that extra precaution.
Yeah, I'm just kind of looking at your all's backgrounds. And you look like you have, you know, some glass enclosures behind you, Shay. And then Jason looks like you've just got, you know, Sterilite bins with some ventilationals. Are those all, both of those are different ways you are keeping or, you know, housing arachnids, or are there different animals?
Yeah, it's both. So the Sterilite tubs we use for scorpions, terrestrials, and fossorials. They have enough the depth in there that we make sure that the substrate's to a certain level. So they have at least about 4 inches to burrow and kind of do what they want to do. As for these are all of our arboreal species. So this whole wall behind me is actually a Vix and Versicolors.
Oh, wow.
And over there, there's like some HMAX, SKELs. On the other sides, a lot of our Postlitheria or Salmophius. And then I also have the Sterilite bins in my room. You can't really see them right now, but this is all of our like tropical stuff. So my room stays about 75 degrees to 80 degrees with about 75% humidity. And the room Jason is in is our arid room. So it's, you know, maybe 50, 60% humidity and roughly still 75 in there, I'd say.
That's one of my secrets. We used to try very hard to keep the environments different inside of the containers, keep humid containers for humid spiders and dry containers for dry spiders. But when they give me a second room, I realized, hey, I can put all my humid rooms over to where Shay is and keep all the arid characters in my room.
I'm sure that does wonders for keeping them. I wish I had two rooms. So what do you suggest for people, you know, like myself or, you know, probably a lot of people listening that don't have that ability to keep, you know, their tropical species in a more humid room versus their more arid species? Yeah. Give them some advice.
Okay. So a lot of people are familiar with CocoCore. It's shredded coconut husk and coconut peat. And if you use that right, it has some interesting properties that can work for you. When you add water to CocoCore, you notice that it dries out very quickly. A lot of people are annoyed by this. Well, wet bedding isn't your goal. Wet air is. And as it's drying out, it's releasing the moisture from the CocoCore into the environment around it slowly and evenly at a rate that it stays all day until it dries out. So the substrate becomes your basically moisture bank to pay that moisture out of the air. Now, if you're using a spider if you're housing a spider that's going to go into that substrate, now you, though, have to be very careful to make sure that it's not staying so wet that it becomes anaerobic and produces potentially parthenogenic bacteria.
Yeah, one issue I've had using cocoa has been mushrooms. Like, it seems anytime I use cocoa fiber and it gets damp for, you know, more than a few days, bright yellow mushrooms start popping up, or I'll get mold issues and to the point I pretty much stopped using it altogether. How do you combat, you know, fungus growth?
It happens. You have to try to keep it out of it. That particular fungus you're dealing with, that bright yellow, it actually favors CocoCore because it does the best when it goes from going wet to drying out. You'll notice that your biggest blooms happen when a wet environment has started to dry out a bit, and then you get that huge bloom. Have to keep up with you. It's not the nature of the CocoCore, because we actually use a slight variation of ABG that hasn't always had core in it, but has always had a mushroom problem on and off, and you just got to get rid of it and keep the contamination out. Otherwise, no matter what substrate you use, it's going to come back sooner or later.
Do you use any like springtails, isopods, anything like that in the enclosures?
We had an instance where someone put in a lot of dwarf whites to our enclosures, and we had to go through and remove them from every single enclosure because the dwarf whites were actually preying on tarantulas that had just molted and egg sacs. So after that, we decided to call it and take all those out. And so now we're going forward with some springtails just to see how environments handle with it. So we tend to avoid isopods here, but springtails, in my personal experience, seem to be much safer, and they do help with the substrate.
Very cool. So you actually have recorded evidence of springtails feeding on molting tarantulas?
Dwarf white isopods.
And a lot of people seem very surprised by that, but they're a lot more carnivorous than you think. I know a guy who discarnated an entire red-eared slider with nothing but dwarf whites. And yeah, we have two situations where we had tarantulas that went into a molt. One was Armenia. One was
HMAC.
HMAC? I don't remember the HMAC. The number? There might be a third.
I have pictures of her legs being eaten at from the dwarf whites after a molt.
I remember that one.
Oh, wow. Oof. That's just been a topic of conversation and debate, at least, you know, in my groups and on videos and stuff. I had Russ from Aquarimax Pets come on, and we did a whole segment on using bioactives for tarantulas and the possible dangers that isopods can present. And just how different species have different diets. They're looking for more calcium than other species. And, you know, he was suggesting some species that may work well for tarantulas, but that has always been a concern, is that when the tarantula is molting, it's very vulnerable that, you know, the isopods might start making a snack. I didn't even think about egg sacs, but yeah, that completely makes sense.
We lost our mini egg sac that way.
You don't suggest anybody use isopods in their enclosures?
Not at all, because here's the problem. Under normal circumstances, when they're being fed well, then they would take the easy food rather than take the hard food. So if you feed your isopods well enough, then you probably won't ever have that problem. But now they're not doing bioactive. They're not feeding on the detritus in your environment. They're feeding on what you're feeding it. You're basically keeping two different species of pets in the same place, not so much a cleaning crew. But as soon as that food goes down, you know, when you're feeding them great. Food supply goes down, then you start on a ticking clock, and sooner or later they're going to notice there's some food in there they haven't made use of.
Now, I like using springtails in my enclosures, but for tarantulas, I don't think I have, unless it's accidental, I don't have any isopods. You know, I do use them in my reptile enclosures that are bioactive, but I just was really worried about that. And the fact that, you know, tarantulas just don't make a whole lot of waste, you know, like there may be some leftover prey or something, but it's not like a gecko or a snake where there's poop and stuff they could feed on.
First, I'd like to make the exception of the entire genus Ephibopus. Dear God, that's disgusting. That's a lot of poop and it's gross. But yeah, most of the waste they make is very little, and they filter out most of their waste before they eat it in the form of the bolus, and that's easily removable.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't had that much. It's the Postlitheria, especially like a couple of those species that it's just constantly just white splatter all over the glass.
All the evicts. So,
exactly why I do not keep them.
I think it was the
weekly. I'm scrubbing these enclosures off the glass.
I can only imagine. So is there a species of tarantulas that, you know, a tarantula that you all prefer to work with over any other?
I'm a Salmophius girl. I love my Victoriae, my Armenia. They're like my go-to. I love to work with them.
Nice.
I've been waiting for this question for the entire podcast. The all-superior genus, Xenesis. How could you not love them?
Say that one more time.
The all-superior genus, Xenesis. How could that not be your favorite?
Okay. Is there a specific species in that genus you like?
Imanus or Species Blue tend to be my favorite.
I do love the Imanus.
Well, there are so many great species out there, but one that fell into my lap and then I got shafted on that I'm trying to get back to is I really, really want to produce Haploclastis divamatha.
I have a couple of those. Well, I only have one now. One of them ended up. What I don't like about that species and species like that is that it's a beautiful spider, but it spends so much time in its burrow. You never really get to enjoy it. One of mine matured male, and I just hadn't seen it for months and months and months, and I didn't realize it had matured out male. And finally, I was like, I got to do like a wellness check on this guy, make sure he's okay, because he wasn't eating. emptied out the enclosure, and it turns out he had just died. And I was like, oh, man, what? Yeah,
they're like 2 months mature. You have such a small window.
Yeah.
But actually, it's interesting. I had a lady who was working on her thesis at MSU come and interview when I was working at Pooh's Pets about why on earth anyone would ever want a trapdoor spider. This animal spends all of its time underground except for when it's eating. Why would somebody want that? And actually, as somebody who sold probably 60 over the course of 20 years, it's because that rareness makes it more special. It's like when you actually see your Viloceps out, it's such a rare and special thing that all of a sudden that's the coolest spider you have. It doesn't matter how rare it is, no matter how beautiful it is, but you actually get to see it. So that rareness makes it even more exciting the few times that you do get to see it.
I would agree with that. There are a few spiders that are like that. I've got some trapdoor spiders, and half the time I don't even get the enjoyment of seeing them feed. Like, I'll drop a cricket in there, I'll have the cameras focused, and we're sitting there for 20 minutes, and it's like nothing's happening. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So I finally turn off the lights and put them back on the shelf, and then walk back by 10 minutes later, and the cricket's gone. I'm like, you just don't want to be on camera. I see what's up.
It can be fun. Have you ever had the armored trapdoors?
No.
Oh, those are so awesome.
Yeah. I've got the, I can't remember the genus name, but it was the Stephen Colberti. I got one of those. I had a Texas trapdoor, a couple other ones. Like, I can't remember any of their scientific names though. But yeah, I think maybe like two or three times I've been able to catch it on camera.
But it just makes it that much more special.
Yeah, it is fun. So beyond tarantulas, what else are you all keeping and breeding over there?
Scorpions. We had ammo pigeons in our program, but we recently dropped those just because it's so hard to get males. And it's the same thing. The male's life expectancy is much shorter than females. So getting them in to breed was quite difficult. As of right now, we did mantises for a little bit. Mantids, not currently at the moment we are, but hopefully in the future. And then, yeah, just lots of scorpions and tarantulas currently.
One of the challenges that we face outside of the spiders is that currently we're choosing to only work with species that we don't have to have permits for, just because so many different states have different permits and it's a lot to keep up with, and they really hurt you if you mess up. So tarantulas, they don't have permits inside of America. Other than CITES and Lacey issues, there's no permits for tarantulas. For some reason, they decided to keep, USFW decided to keep their hands off of that. But once you get into mantises and other bugs, it gets right back there. And I'd love to keep some of the coolest mantises out there, but we're currently only going to be able to keep those species that are either introduced or are already endemic into America.
Gotcha. I was surprised talking to Aquarimax, just all the regulations he has to deal with selling isopods. It's like, oh, yeah. I couldn't imagine that. And it just didn't compute for me thinking, you know, tarantulas versus isopods. You would think the tarantulas would be more heavily regulated, but I guess they're not a threat to indigenous plant life and things like that in the same way that isopods would be. Is that the
same? We got two things going in our favor. One is that there has only ever been one introduced species of tarantula in America ever. And two, I think just most USFW are too afraid of spiders to care.
And you're referring to the Mexican red rumps in Florida, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Supposedly the only true red rumps, whatever.
Yeah.
we also work with jumpers. We've started that project up.
That's true. You guys are working with jumping spiders?
Yeah.
Which species? Is it just the Regius or?
We have the Regius, the Audax, and then we are about to order in some other stuff to get going. Because they're so teeny as babies coming out of the egg sac, I literally take a little paintbrush and coax them out. And I've been able to raise them up and get them to about juvenile state before we determine that they're ready to sell. So that's been pretty cool. It's a good milestone to have the jumpers.
They're insanely popular right now. I get surprised.
Oh, yeah.
How many people are keeping them? And it seems every time Tarantula Cat makes a video on it, it does amazing. And, you know, and they're adorable. I get it, but the things I don't like about them is they don't live very long. And then the baby issue, like, I don't know how many times I've gotten a jumping spider, you know, and I'm assuming that they're wild caught, and, you know, then I have an egg sac And I'm like, oh, I didn't breed it. So hopefully it's not a viable sac. And then one day I come in and there's just tiny jumpers crawling out of ventilation holes and infesting my house.
Been there.
So how do you guys deal with, you know, when you've got egg sacs, you know, you whether it's a tarantula or a jumping spider or anything like that, and they produce all these tiny little spiderlings. Like, what is your process of separating them and rearing them at such a small size?
Well, it goes in stages. First, when we pull the sac, we have an incubator that we made so that we care for the sac before pre-diaspora, before their 2i. And then we tend to those daily until we watch them go to their second instar. And that's when we transport them into the container. And depending on how big the spider is, it could be anything as small as these little 2 ounce containers with literally pinholes stuck through them on up to, I don't know if I've ever had anybody come out of a sack big enough for these guys, but this is the largest of our small containers. But yeah, we just, I don't know if I'll be able to point this at you, but down there, we just had an HMAC sack that we popped over into those spice jars. And for terrestrials, we got some Samadhi down there that we got in, and we put those in little 7 ounce cubes. So each to their environment.
Also depends if they're medically significant. If they are medically significant species that we work with, we take a little extra precaution to make sure the container is extra sealed.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my next questions. Is I think anybody that's ever kept tarantulas, especially if you've got a large collection, occasionally one or two are going to escape. Like, have you all had any issues with tarantulas escaping, and how do you handle that?
Just last week, we actually got some new soffits, and I went through and put them on over 100 enclosures. I'm finishing up the last bit of it now.
But primarily, we handle that actually in preparation. When we designed the two tarantula rooms, we went through with great stuff and sealed any cracks, anywhere that a spider can get into that we can't easily get to. And then we choose things that are in here that you can easily get into, around, and under, so that when a spider gets out, we can find them quickly. I don't think we've had an adult spider out for longer than like 3 days.
You know, I also have catch cups everywhere.
Nice.
She's not kidding. Everywhere.
It's the way to be. Now, I've noticed just here in my own collection, keeping this basement ideal, in an ideal environment for arachnids, that not only does it keep my spiders healthy and comfortable, but it also creates an ideal environment for other spiders. So I've got, you know, all kinds of house spiders and wolf spiders and things like that setting up shop in here. Do you guys have a similar problem in your facility?
Sure. Unfortunately.
For those listening, everyone's shaking their head yes.
Shay, can I get you to reach under your desk and bring out the bug Zooka?
Yes, so we call these little spiders freeloaders because they're not supposed to be here. They eat the food that gets out like the fruit flies, and they get into our enclosures. We've had them, you know, kill some of our baby spiderlings, so we had to up protocols on that. And every week we go through, and if there's some on any big enclosures, we pull them out. But you don't want to reach your hand into a Plosotheria tank and just kind of move it around. So instead, we get this fun thing. And it has a nozzle that you attach to the front with two little flaps. And so you push this in. There's a button on it. And it pops out. And the flap will, like, suck it in.
I am trying to figure out how to describe that to people listening. But it's kind of like a it's called Bugzooka. So I guess you could just Google it.
On Amazon.
That's interesting.
Describing it and how it works. It's got a bellows at the end that's spring-loaded that you press in. And then when you hit the trigger, it shoots out, expanding, drawing all that air from the only place it can, right there at the nozzle. A half second of a pretty decent puff of suction.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a split-second vacuum, and it just sucks in, yes, you know, the spiders. So, I mean, what...
But we also have the vacuum. Do you have the vacuum under there, Shay?
Yes.
This is an ongoing battle. I adapted a little
dirt devil
buster.
Oh, okay.
Dirt devil. Mm-hmm. So that we can get into the corners and suck those little freeloaders out of there.
So is it just like a PVC pipe or something like that you got duct taped onto the end of it?
Gorilla tape. That's the stuff.
Nice. That's handy. I might have to make one of those for myself. I mean, I haven't had a problem with them so much getting into, they get into enclosures, but a lot of times it's like, they're not doing any damage. Like, especially my scorpion enclosures, somehow for some reason, they seem to really like that. They'll set up shop in there, but they're tiny little house spiders. So it almost looks more like it's just the scorpion's pet than anything is going to cause damage. But I guess if you're breeding and stuff.
Yeah. For us, unfortunately, they managed to get inside the ventilation holes of some of our containers. And then we'll go to feed, not so much now, but before, which caused the war, we go to feed our spider. And we see him in a little lump of silk. And we see a big, fat latrodectin spider in there. And I don't feel good about the fact of how many spiders I've killed, but I do what I have to do.
What kind of spiders are you dealing with that are freeloaders? I mean, I don't know what's common up there.
Two main. One is some latrodectin relative. It might be Geometricus. It might be the False Widow. And then we have a lot of the cellar spiders, the ones that some people call Daddy Long Legs.
I don't even know which spiders I'm dealing. I know that there's definitely wolf spiders, and I could probably just look around and find them. But I kind of like keeping them around, mainly because they clean up my mess. Like, I lose so many crickets, like the one that was crawling on the wall before we started talking. And I'll flip over a table or move a desk or a shelf or something like that, and I'll find some really fat spiders with crickets or fruit flies wrapped up in its web. I'm like, thank you so much for picking up my mess. I appreciate that.
So we kept them around at first. At first it was, oh, cool, you know, they're cleaning up the mess. And then they started breeding at crazy numbers. And that's when it became an issue, is the little babies would get into the ventilation holes and then eat what the tarantula didn't eat. And it would grow to size till where it could take down the baby tarantula. And so, you know, we're going to prioritize our tarantulas over.
Right.
That makes sense.
It's too bad I can't use the solution I used when I was working at Proust Pets. We're a containment facility, so I actually got downvoted on this one. When we moved to the new location at Proust's, we let loose about 5 dozen Turkish house geckos into the department. And to this date, I'm sure there's like 300-400. I used to find the eggs all over the place. And they'd breed, eat loose crickets, eat any other little bugs wandering around.
Nice. I actually had a guy on the podcast a couple months ago. And he has a free-range tokay gecko in his house, essentially to do that. And like, it got out, and he was just like, we'll just let it stay out because it's eating all the crickets and other bugs in my reptile room. And I was like, hey, you're a brave man. I don't know how I'd feel with a tokay.
Till the one day he puts his hand in the wrong place and he hears the sound of an angry duck.
Yeah. Now, there's one question that I get asked all the time. And since I'm not a dealer, I never know the answer to it. But since I've got you guys here, I'm going to ask you all and see if you want to answer it. But people are very curious how you get the spiders, whether they're spiderlings or full-grown tarantulas, into those shipping containers, you know, like where you have it all wrapped up. Like, how do you get them in there for the shipping process?
Okay. So really, a large part of what my job entails is chasing around baby spiders, whether I'm feeding them or shipping them. The way that we ship the majority of our babies now is we've moved away from the wet paper towels and instead use vials, stuff some sphagnum moss in there, use a pen to make a hollow in the center, chase the baby in there, and put a little plug of sphagnum above it. So that way it's got soft, fluffy, moist sphagnum all around it to keep it hydrated and protected until it gets to your home.
You know, I've noticed a few different tarantula dealers recently have switched over to using sphagnum moss instead of paper towels or, you know, whatever else they were using. Like, what are the benefits to using the sphagnum moss?
Well, the problem with the paper towel is it doesn't have much compression left to it, especially the way we have to wrap it around and stuff it in there. So the paper towel actually has very little cushion. It also is either very little water available, or it's soaked. It's really going to be nothing in between. The sphagnum is spread around, so there's a lot more air pockets inside. It's compressible so that as the spider hits something that would push it against the side, that sphagnum is slowing down and cushioning it, whereas the packed paper towel only has so much cushion before it hits hard. So we changed our shipping policies slightly, and since we shipped to the sphagnum, I'm not sure we've had one single death in shipping.
Oh, wow. This is
about a year. When did we shift, Shay? Do you remember?
About a year ago.
About a year ago. And not one single death in shipping.
That's very cool.
And also, we have an amazing shipping department. That's part of what makes Josh's Frogs mighty. He started out knowing how to do two things well. One, breed dart frogs. But there was a lot of people out there who could breed dart frogs at the time, and you probably haven't heard of them because they came and went. Two, he knew how to safely and inexpensively ship it, its food, its environment, and all of its needs directly to people's houses, and to get them there safely.
The first half of it is we see our order pop up, and so we get the animal, make sure it's healthy, pack it up, and then we take it down to our vertebrae shipping team, and they handle if it needs a cold pack, a heat pack, you know, what environment it's getting shipped to. We check the weather, and so they kind of handle all that for us, and then it's only through FedEx because they're the only place that does live animal shipments.
So are you all the ones responsible for getting them into the vials, or do you just bring them down to the shipping department in their enclosures and they handle that?
Nope, we do that.
Oh, okay.
We hand them off the animal with its label and its vials, and they get into the boxes, and they are so high tech, like they don't use heating and ship and cooling packs anymore. That's old tech. Instead, they have something that we sell on our site that is a type of oil. And what it does, it changes state very slowly. So instead of having a cold pack, which is too cold near your spiders to keep it from getting too hot, we now have these oils that we either keep in the solid state, cold, or liquid state, hot. And we put that in there with a spider. And as the temperature inside would have changed to match the temperature outside, that temperature difference is being absorbed by that oil. So without having to be hotter or colder than you want your spider, it's helping to maintain that temperature. That's part of, I think, why we have such a low mortality rate.
Yeah, I got a Monocentrophis balfouri communal from you all for a video. And I saw that when I was unboxing it. I was like, what in the world is this?
I don't think we can disclose what exactly it is.
I understand.
But
we can disclose that you can buy it from us.
There you go. Yeah, but it was interesting. I mean, I'm used to seeing those either pretty much an ice pack or a little hand warmer type deal. Made specifically for shipping reptiles and stuff. But when I saw that, I think even in the video, I don't know if I cut it or not, but I was like, what in the, like, this must be the temperature control thing. But it was odd looking. I don't think I've ever seen it since.
Your amusement. I was like, hey, that's pretty cool. Maybe we should explain what that was.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, they're also biodegradable. I'm pretty sure that was something I'd read about them.
Well, the oil is, the packages are,
like, I appreciate your old answer, but I don't think you really got to the core of what I was asking, what people are wanting to know. And that is, how do you get the tiny spot? Like, I understand you put the sphagnum moss in there, you make a hole, but it's the science, I guess, or the talent of getting the spiderling to go inside there. Like, I think that's what most people are mystified by. Like, do you use tubes, funnels? Like, how do you convince a spiderling to go inside there?
So what I like to do is I will take a little tub. It's about this big. It's a 16-quart tub. And I will empty the spiderling right into that tub. And I'll take a paintbrush and I'll chase the spiderling along the crack of the tub into that funneling hole of, like, the sphagnum moss. And he will just, oddly enough, they jump right in there, huddle down, and it's almost like they enjoy the comfortability of the restricted area.
Gotcha.
Well, they're looking for a hiding place.
Yeah.
I'd like to add to that, though. A couple of things. One, what really helps out with that is we use containers that we hit with liquid Teflon on the top. So that way they can't just go ripping up the top and out. Two, this is good advice from my friend Mindy that works here. This is not a paintbrush. It's an eyeshadow brush, and it's even softer than a paintbrush. So we chase around with that. The other is to know the behavior of the spider. Different species are going to act differently. When I'm trying to container up a regalis, then I'll actually hold the vial upside down on top of their container when I've taken the lid off, and I will chase them. And they will do what Pokey's doing. They're disturbed. They run up. They'll run right into that vial. And then the other is when you get terrestrials, then you put it down along the edge down here. And they want to run down along the ground into some place where they can't be seen. your vial. So you make it in their interest. You outthink them as well as outmove them.
So it's kind of like you're just kind of corralling them into the container.
Very much corralling.
Gotcha.
And chasing babies around. That's what I do. My job badly, I chase baby spiders around.
Hey, because I've heard some interesting theories about, you know, from people trying to figure it out. Like one guy asked me if you all, or not you all in particular, but, you know, people that ship spiders, if they're like using tweezers and picking them up and shoving them in there. And I was like, I think that would be dangerous. That would not be something you want to do. But I don't know how they're actually doing it.
I think the worst thing to pack for me personally is actually VersiColors, because without fail, the second you take that lid off, it runs onto you.
Yeah.
Like the Teflon does not matter. It will run over it. Those things are crazy.
Actually, I'd like to share with you, Jay, because I recently came up with a way to deal with that. Oh, yeah? And shared with you guys, and I'll share with you, Richard, something I think is very funny about particularly Versys, but all spiders, is as much as many people think they're gross, they think we're gross, particularly our hair. Seems like they're fuzzy, but those aren't hair. Those are setae. Our hair is gross to them. If you ever had a spiderling running along your forearm where it's very hairy, then they hate it. So normally I can't get those darn Versys to get in the vial and stay in the vial. They run up on your hand. They're all over the place. So I wait for them to get there, regret their decision, put the vial on top of them. And again, they go in their best interest.
I don't think I mentioned it while we were recording, but right before we started recording this podcast, I was shooting a video about, or part of a video about gut loading insects. So I've got like carrots and apples and stuff behind me, and I haven't had lunch. So I am, I'm eating my cricket's food right now.
All right, be careful, because now you're technically gut loaded. So someone even tastier. Yeah.
So do you guys gut load your feeder insects? I mean, is that something you deal with, or do you have a whole other department that does that?
So I actually hired in on our insect packing team of Josh's Frogs. I transferred to the arachnid department several months after I initially hired in. And we have an entire team dedicated to packing our feeder bugs. And part of that is when we get our crickets in for orders, specifically the gut loaded orders, they will gut load them, and they just prep the cup. They label it. They put in like some carrot and some food for it. And yeah, there's a whole team for that.
So, but the spiders that, the insects that you're feeding the spiders, you haven't stocked. Like what do you use as far as gut loading? Or, I mean, just kind of explain, cause I realized recently that there's like this misconception, at least with keepers. They think they go to Petco or somewhere like that. They buy crickets, they bring it home, they feed them. They're gut loaded. They've got everything they need. And from my experience, at least the local stores around here, they're not gut loading those crickets. They just give them water crystals, and they're flipping them real fast. Like they get them in. So a lot of times they're missing that nutritional value that they should have. So, I mean, could you give keepers some advice on how, you know, the best ways to gut load insects for invertebrates?
The first is the easy, and that's what we're doing, is we have a cricket formula that we sell that we also use that is specifically to make them gut load. And that's what Shay was describing, that we send out with our gut loaded crickets that we're sending out to customers. We keep our own crickets here for the pet bugs team, and we feed them the gut load. One thing that perhaps I'm missing the opportunity of that I did at home, and I encourage people to do at home, is when you have leftovers, don't waste them. That apple that you're eating, Richard, don't throw that core away. Throw it in with your crickets. Done eating orange. Did you know the peel has as much vitamin C as the actual fruit does? Crickets are garbage disposals. And by offering them a variety of different healthy foods, don't give them junk food, then you can actually supplement with real whole foods some of that gut loading. But you should put that on a platform of a nice broad-based gut-loaded cricket food like you can buy here.
Okay, so you're suggesting feed them fruits and vegetables and stuff, you know, pretty much out of your fridge, or, you know, the waste
as well,
the peels, but in addition to a gut loading diet.
And then I should have made the warning ahead of time that the food in your refrigerator has been attempted to be made specifically safe from bugs. So anytime you're offering any food that was meant for humans to bugs, it should be rinsed very thoroughly. It was made to be deadly to bugs.
So you got to make sure you get all those pesticides, insecticides, all that stuff off. I mean, really, we should be doing that before we eat it too, because it's probably not good for us. But yeah, that's definitely a good point. So do you guys, another common debate, do you dust feeders before you feed them to arachnids, or do you just gut load?
Not to arachnids. The problem with the dusting is there's two different types of dusting, and they are kept separate for a reason. There's mineral dusting and vitamin dusting, and if you put them together, they actually destroy each other. That's why calcium is packaged with other minerals, but not vitamins. And when they are, you know that product is garbage because the two will destroy each other. An animal with a keratinous exoskeleton doesn't have the calcium need that reptiles that need a two-part calcium to one-part phosphorus ratio. So we don't worry about that. And as far as the other dusts, I can't imagine any of that being as digestible as actual foods. And our cricket food is made up of an amalgam of actual foods.
You know, part of the reason is I'm asking you this is to get that information out there, but also to make sure that the video I just recorded isn't full of bull crap. But so I'm just fact checking myself. I'll make sure that we're on the same page here.
We think gut loading is very, very important. It sounds like you have a reptile, a stutter, and the exotic pet, Kavi, when you say you are what you eat eats. If you feed your animal junk, then they unfortunately will not thrive.
So yeah, I'm glad we can get that out there. But while we're on, you know, not so much controversial topics, but you know, possibly controversial, what about water? I don't know how active you are online, but for the past year, there has been some pretty heated arguments between people, whether you can use tap water to water your tarantula, like, you know, fill up a water bowl in the tarantula's enclosure, or if it should be distilled water, or should it be reverse osmosis water? Should it be treated tap water? So what do you all do as far as, you know, the water that you use for watering them or, you know, getting their substrate damp, stuff like that?
We actually use RO water mostly because of that's what we have most available to us. With so many other ways that they can get to the minerals that are missing in RO water, I don't feel too bad offering them that. But if someone was to ask me what's the best they can do, probably the best they can do is spring and mineral water. Tap water actually depends on where you live. We're 20 minutes outside of Flint, where I would drink that tap water on a triple dog dare. But then Lansing actually has fantastic water, so good that it's great for growing orchids. So tap water is a gamble depending on where you are. RO water exclusively is not the best thing in the world, but if you're gut loading, then you can make up for that.
So you said spring water or mineral water would be your first pick?
Absolutely, because it doesn't have the things that we add to our tap water to make it safe, like chlorine and chloramines. And worth pointing out that while chlorines evaporate at room temperature, chloramines don't. That's why they put it in there. Some places put fluoride, some places Flint add lead. So you don't know what else you're getting in there. What you're getting in tap water was made to get it to a human safely. Whereas with RO water, you at least know what you're not getting. And mineral water and spring water, in theory, is the best, but then you're just gambling on whether your spring water came out of a tap in Chicago.
That's a very good point. I've even had some people express concern about using RO water or distilled water or even spring water that they're buying from the store. One, because they don't actually know if it's, you know, where the source is and if it's contaminated with anything, but they're also concerned about the fact that it's stored in a plastic bottle and that, you know, particulates from the plastic could get in there. And, you know, there was a theory going around that that could be one of the main causes of DKS and tarantulas is water coming from plastic bottles. And I don't know if there's any facts to that or if you all, you know, in your experience have ever seen a correlation at all.
No, I think that's a real tough stretch.
Yeah.
I've never experienced DKS myself yet.
I have seen DKS in several situations, or at least symptoms that would have been called DKS. And I am now convinced that DKS is not at all a syndrome, but a symptom. And it could be a symptom of different things. The pulchers that were coming out of Germany 10 years ago, those were coming with DKS. That was something that was being passed on genetically. I had a Amelia come into Proust Pets that had DKS, and it was surrendered to me, and I had it for 3 days before I noticed the room, what are they called?
Air freshener.
The room air freshener that was stuck on the side of the tank.
Oh, geez.
In that case, it was intoxicated. It was being poisoned. And then I've seen spiders who get extremely dehydrated display symptoms of DKS, but then after a couple of days of being rehydrated, they no longer show the symptoms and never show it in the future. So yeah, I think it's a symptom, not a syndrome.
Yeah, I would agree. Cause I've had, you know, some tarantulas that have shown, you know, the DKS kind of behaviors, and it's never been, I just don't like even using the word DKS, even though we've just said it a lot on the podcast, because it's, you know, you can't tell if it's genetic, if it's environmental, you know, because I think that there is some situations where, I mean, I don't know, I'm not a biologist or anything like that, but sometimes it seems that, you know, there are specific species coming from a specific source that are having problems that most likely seem to be more genetic. Like, I don't know if they're just, you know, inbreeding so much that maybe that's causing problems, or they have a bad female that is just passing on those bad genes. But then I've also seen people that will have a collection, like someone just posted recently on Facebook, 5 of their tarantulas in their room are showing, you know, DKS kind of symptoms, and they're trying to figure out like what's wrong. And it's like, well, if they're different species from different sources, you would logically think that it's something in the environment. Like there's something going on in your room, you know, or maybe what you're feeding them, or, you know, so it's like this broad term that is describing a situation or an issue with a tarantula that honestly, we just don't even know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys have an entomologist on staff there. I mean, have they ever given their kind of opinion on DKS or anything like that?
Here's the sad fact about the state of tarantulaology in the entomology field. There's almost no differences, so almost nobody does any work on it. There is so little that is done on tarantulas. When you look across the board at Arenomorphidae, there's so many different types of venoms, all these different, very different body things. And in tarantulas, though, to us, an H. chilensis looks extremely different than a T. apophysis. To a biologist, they're not different enough to even bother.
Yeah, it's kind of frustrating when you're talking to different entomologists, at least when I've been talking to them, and they're just tarantulas. You know, like they kind of brush them off as not that interesting. You know, they like the more advanced species of spiders, I would think. Everybody loves to study jumping spiders and stuff like that, but not so much the tarantulas.
Yeah, unfortunately, we work with here and at my last job, probably the premier pet vet, exotic pet vet in the state, Dr. Wayne Beasley of Cedar Creek. And he used to see all our animals at Prusa's, and I'd asked him questions about tarantulas, and I'd say, Jason, don't you realize that when it comes up to tarantulas, I'm asking you? No one has ever bought a tarantula into my practice. Ever. He's had capuchins, wallabies, all sorts of birds of prey, all these exotic animals. Not once has anyone ever brought a tarantula to him.
Yeah. See, I live in a small town, but we've got this one really good vet, and he sees pretty much any animal, you know, I mean, from like leopard geckos to horses, and he's very knowledgeable. And most of the pet shops around here, they bring their snakes to him and chameleons, and you know, he's really good. And, you know, that's where I take my dogs and cats. And I had asked him once, you know, if I have a problem with my tarantula, could I bring it in? He was like, absolutely not. Like, I'm not going to, like, there's nothing I could do for a tarantula. Like, I don't have any experience. There's no medicine. I don't know of any research that's been done on different diseases and stuff like that. He's like, I mean, you could, but I'm telling you that I probably wouldn't be able to help you at all. And I'm like, that's so frustrating that there's like no study into this science. You know, I've seen a couple of exotic pet vets on Instagram that have talked about it, and they've done things like healing wounds, or, you know, I think there was a video going around for a while of a tarantula that got caught in some duct tape, you know, and they were trying to remove that.
I actually got a hold of a book on arthropods in general, and it was mostly saltwater, but it actually did have a section that talked about how to anesthetize a tarantula. It's just very rare. The good news, though, is with so much money that's coming into the hobby over the last decade, and that seems to only be growing, that's going to attract attention. And more people going into vet school will have kept spiders and have an interest in pushing that forward. So I do look forward to that changing in the future.
Yeah, that would be awesome. That kind of leads me to my next question is, why is Josh's Frogs even selling tarantulas or invertebrates? Like, how did you all move into that direction?
I think it was more so a company decision to move forward several hobbies. We love doing captive bred things. We work with a lot of, you know, conservation programs. And so to get that ball rolling, it's just something that we love doing. And the more we can expand that out into, the better.
So was it just like people that were working there that kind of brought it to the attention? Like, hey, there is a market here for tarantulas. This is a growing hobby within the exotic pet hobby. Or, you know, like, I'm just curious. Like, it's not like accusational or anything like that. I've always kind of wondered how somebody goes from dart frogs to all these other different frogs and amphibians and reptiles. And then, yeah, we're also breeding tarantulas too. It's kind of like, well, that, I mean, they're similar, but they also are worlds apart.
I've literally been asked, why is Josh's Frogs doing tarantulas? Because the name is Josh's Frogs. But our goal is to replace wild-caught animals with captive-bred animals. And so we're eventually spreading out to all the exotic pet hobby. I had been whispering in Josh's ears, like I said, for the better part of a decade and a half before he got around to it. And they were just feeling out the possibility. They'd gotten in a couple of albos, some Cambridge eye and for breeding, and then spider stock to resell. And then when I got hired, they hadn't gone anywhere with it yet. It was literally that new. And I paired the very first albos, and you know, the people who run Josh's Frogs, they're not spider people, so they didn't know whether or not this is going to work. They needed some trigger to feel like this is potential. And before that, all they'd ever had was a rose hair that came in and dropped a sack for them, which they did manage to successfully rear up and sell. Very proud of them. But once I got that first breeding of the albos, that's when Zach Brinks, the ops manager, came and said, so, do you think you could spend $10,000 on breeding stock? I said, yes. Yes, I can.
Easy.
So, and we got to be very careful. We're not going to say any names or anything like that. But there is this kind of just this understanding, I think, in the tarantula hobby that anytime a reptile business or an amphibian business, I mean, mainly just reptiles, start selling tarantulas, they're going to be wild caught. They're going to be sick. They're not going to be packaged correctly. Like there's some big businesses out there that maybe I'm not huge in the reptile hobby, so I don't know if they're reputable when it comes to that. But they're, when you Google it, like they're usually the first, you know, businesses that pop up that you can order from. But they are known to, you know, be selling the wrong species, or the species that'll have nematodes or mites, or they'll ship it in a deli cup with a bunch of substrates. And you know, there's a bad rap that comes from a reptile dealer selling tarantulas. How do you guys overcome that kind of stereotype?
I think I'd like to take this one, if you don't mind, Jay. I think something I really admire about this company is that each department is broke down into divisions, and each division has its own set of professionals in that hobby. So every animal we work with is getting that dedicated care that they need to constantly improve the hobby. We're always looking for ways to be more efficient, you know, make things better for them, kind of do more research into them. So I think a way to stray away from that is that we don't just have anyone coming in here to work with these animals. We have individuals who are extremely passionate that want the best for this. So it's not just anyone off the street. You know, we want to make sure that you really love what you're doing.
But I mean, even if you go to a reptile expo, you know, like go to NARBC, you'll have tarantula dealers that will have booths, and they're selling pretty much 100% tarantulas. They know the species names. You know, they know the husbandry, where they come from. I mean, they got a whole wealth of information. You go to the next aisle, there's some guy selling ball pythons, and on the end of his table, he's got a couple of deli cups with tarantulas in them, and he's usually selling them cheaper than what the dealers are, which is usually indicative that they're wild caught. They just kind of bought them off whoever they're sourcing their reptiles from as an afterthought to sell. And they don't, like, I went to one, it was a small expo, it wasn't in ARBC, it was a small one here in West Virginia, but the guy was selling snakes, and he had some spiders, and all they said were, baboon tarantula. And I was like, well, which species of baboon tarantula? There's a lot of tarantulas that are referred to as baboons. He's like, I don't know, just open it up and take a look. I opened up one. It was an OBT. I was like, whoa, put that lid back on there. I opened up the next one. It was an HMAC, both with the same name on the enclosure. I'm like, these are wildly different tarantulas, and they're not the type of tarantulas you should just be telling someone to open up and look at. Like, If I didn't know what I was doing, it could have been in a dangerous situation. Especially, I freaked out because they were almost full grown, you know. So like, it was it freaked me out. And it was just the irresponsibility of this dealer. It just kind of shocked me, but it's something that I've seen over and over again. And I know just by talking to you all and having, you know, gotten tarantulas from you before in the past that you're not a business that does things like that, but it does seem that that is kind of the standard, you know, when it comes to, and people listening to this right now, maybe like, I would never buy a tarantula from Josh's Frogs because they're a reptile business, you know, that's what their focus is. So like, I understand what you're saying, Shay, but how do you get that word out there to people that, you know, may be a little hesitant from ever buying a tarantula from a business that specializes in reptiles and amphibians?
I think education is the best way to move forward. The more we get out there and talk with people, whether it's at trade shows, doing shows like this, advertisement, just talking with people in general, the best way to inform is to educate. So there's a difference in, you know, communication and comprehension. So actually getting that, you know, base level with them, like, hey, you know, this is why we should move forward with captive bred. This is, you know, the way that we're really trying to get a goal with. It's just about getting it out there that, you know, wild caught isn't always the healthiest method.
Right. I don't think it ever is.
I'd like to add to that if I can. I would actually state that it is actually the direction that our hobby is going. A lot of people don't realize that in the year 2000, almost nobody knew how to breed a tarantula. Almost nobody. None of the tarantulas available, with very rare exceptions, were captive bred. That was just the norm. But things have changed, and they're continuing to change. Even Stan Schultz, the author of the Tarantula Keeper's Guidebook, has reflected that. He's coming out with his fifth edition, I think. And the difference between the new edition and the old editions are the old editions were, if you read them, reflective of the hobby at the time. All that was available was wild caught. And nobody knew much about them when I first started working at Prusa's Pets. It was all wild caught. They had no babies. But more and more people are breeding. The word's getting out there to the point where our demographic, they're no longer going to accept the wild caught anymore. They're more and more going to realize them for being the cruel joke that they were, that under those circumstances, they've been poorly treated. And without any education, they're going to continue to be. But more and more, they're going to be people like, you know, the private breeders online that are big. And then more and more companies our size are going to be moving to exclusively wild caught. It's inevitable. Why was it the way it was? Because that's all we had. But now we have options. And we're one of the people out there making the options.
And I'm just going to play devil's advocate here for a second. And Shay, you kind of already answered this, but just, you know, really kind of hone in on it. And Austin, feel free to speak up if you want. What do you say to people that are, and again, I know this is about all exotic pets on this podcast, but I'm kind of coming from a perspective of a person that mainly keeps tarantulas. What do you say to people that are like, you've got too many irons in the fire? Like you've got too many different types of species. Like I've been to your all's table a few times, or your booth at NARBC, and you've got frogs and you've got turtles and you've got tarantulas and you've got all kinds of invertebrates, but also all kinds of plants. And that whole kind of concept of a jack of all trade is a master of none, you know, like how do you kind of combat that?
And the master of one.
That's true.
That's the whole thing. Remember?
Yeah. But I mean, there's just still that stigma of how can we trust that you're an expert in breeding and selling tarantulas when it's obvious you're also doing all these other different species?
I think it's a really, 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 really good thing to let people know that we aren't just doing everything, and we have like individual teams for everyone. Like you say, jack of all trades means master of none, but then we add the S to jacks of all trades, because there's tons of us and we're all doing everything we can to keep every division in perfect tip-top shape.
Like, could you maybe just expand a little bit on how it's all, I mean, you like Shay mentioned that everybody's kind of in their own departments and then there's different levels in that department, but I mean, could you maybe just kind of expand on that a little bit more so, you know, people have a better understanding of exactly what the layout is? Because I think it's a hard thing to kind of envision, because people, you know, I've never actually been to your facility, so I've only seen it through, you know, clips on Instagram and stuff like that. But I mean, so it's hard to kind of understand the scale, like, you know, how large of a facility it is or how small, or, you know, how many employees are in each department and, you know, things like that.
I think there's a lot of variables in that. And something that is really nice about this company is it's a very special type of culture. Everyone here gets along relatively well. And while we might not know everyone specifically, we know that they at least have that passion and that's why they're here. So how we kind of break things down is, so let's say plant department. We have people dedicated to doing like aquatic plants. We have people dedicated to horticulture where they're constantly, you know, propagating the plant and putting it where it needs to be and making sure it has that care. We have people who just pack plants. You know, they know what it is. They are familiar with it, but they pack it up and send it out to make sure it's safe to being sent. Insect department, we have insect packing team. We have microfeeder team. We have roach team. We have pet bugs team. And each team can be anywhere from, let's say, 2 to 5 people, usually. If it's a bigger department, sometimes more. So, you know, tree frogs, toads, it's all split up to people who have their own individual interests.
Yeah. I know communicating with you all, I was getting very confused because not in this instance, but in the past, I would be talking to someone, you know, from the pet bug team, and I would be asking questions about plants, and they're like, oh, well, I need to forward you over there. They'll be able to answer those questions for you. So then I'm talking to somebody else, and then another question would come up, and they're like, well, let me forward you over to that team. And I'm just like, how many people are here? Like, I'm, you know, when you're thinking of the arachnid hobby, most of these dealers are, you know, mom and pop shops. There's, you know, maybe one person, and maybe they'll have a couple of employees, if that. So it can be, you know, the assumption is that's the same thing with Josh's Frogs, but from what you all are saying, it's nothing like that at all.
We have
to see it to believe it.
Is that an invitation, Austin?
Yes, it is actually an invitation.
Very much so, Richard.
I was going to say that we have two different locations. One is a 10,000 square foot facility that we do our dry goods and our insect fulfillment team. The other is what I'm in right now is a 5-story, 100-year-old building that used to be a coffin factory.
That's awesome.
And we've got it all built out. You go to fourth floor where I'm on right now. You look in one room, you'll find Shay with the human spiders, me with the arid. We got a springtail production room. We got 2 roach production rooms, 3 fruit fly production rooms, 3 isopod production rooms. And that's just this floor. And then everything breaks out. You know, you get the amphibian team where we got some people are breeding poison dart frogs. Some people are specialized in mantellas. Others are specialized in the toads, like the pixies and the patmans and things like that. Got others that are dealing with the various phylum-reducing frogs, like the red eye, the fringe, the black eye, and all of those relatives. And just every time I look, the stuff we have is getting more and more elite. We got Crusia hylocraspidopus in. We've got both colors of, brain fart, little cute monitor.
Ackies.
Acanthurus. We got both red and yellow ackies now. They got in another monitor, but I didn't get a good look at it. But it was bigger and darker. Just every corner of this place is filled by a passionate hobbyist that this is what we do with our life. This is what we do with our spare time. This is what we look up for fun. And Josh finds someone who is properly skilled and experienced in the right place and plugs us in.
So what's the hiring process like then at Josh's Frogs? Like during the interview, do they ask you what kind of pets you've kept in the past or something like that? Or are they out headhunting people? Like, well, how do you get employees?
We have an HR department that works on getting our employees. This department is looking forward to getting another team member soon. Oops. we work with LinkedIn, and that's the one I know, and like 4 other different hiring, because we have like 8 positions in the whole company right now.
I'm just curious, like, you know, I apply for a job at a bank or something, and they're going to be like, are you proficient in Word and Excel and things like that? So in your hiring process, are you asking people like, have you ever fed a tarantula before? Or like,
I'll tell you a secret that we don't normally tell, and hopefully it doesn't bite us in the butt. It's not what you know, because we've hired experts and we've hired newbies. Whatever you knew before you started working this job 40 hours a week is nothing compared to what you're going to learn actually doing it. What we're looking for is the spark, the passion, the desire to want to take this further. We have three core values in the store and this company, and one of them is constantly growing. We want somebody who wants to help take the ship and move it further than it's ever been before, achieve things that we've never done before. So it's not what you know. I hired an expert once that I regret every single day I work. But then I heard someone that I thought didn't know that much about spiders, and they turned out to be the best employee I ever had. So
yeah,
it's that spark. That's what we need. You look at my coworkers, they've got it. Ask them a transfer question and look at the light of their eyes. That's what I want.
Nice. Yeah. In a different lifetime, I ran, managed restaurants and coffee shops and stuff like that. And I worked for this woman once. I ran the coffee shop up front, and she was a baker. So she made all kinds of different breads and scones and delicious stuff. And during the hiring process, if you had experience working in a bakery, you were immediately disqualified. She would not hire you. Wow. She only wanted people that could be taught, that had the willingness to learn and the passion to create amazing stuff. But if you already were like setting your ways on how a kitchen was going to be run or how things are going to be baked, she didn't even want to deal with you. So I always found that really interesting. It's kind of cool to hear you guys have a similar.
And I actually have a question that goes along lines for that. And that's if you say I'm interviewing you, Richard, mm-hmm. if you were to come work for us and you saw us doing something that you thought either wasn't as good as it could be improved, wasn't safe, or different than what you're used to doing it, how would you deal with that? And I'm looking for people who are going to say, I'm going to share what I know and see what they're doing and be open-minded and accept if people are going to do things differently, because you're not going to find any keeper that does things the same way as any other keeper.
It's very true.
So I'm looking for people who can bring things to the table and share what they have, but not miss out on what we've already got on the table.
Yeah. And that's something I learn every day doing what I do, is that I can't get set in my ways, because one, especially with the tarantula hobby, like we were talking earlier, I mean, you read all the different versions of the Tarantula Keeper's Handbook and it's constantly being updated. Things are being changed as we learn more about keeping these spiders in captivity. I know when I got my first tarantula and I got the Tarantula Keeper's Handbook at the time, I think it was suggesting a substrate of vermiculite, and even had like a drawing of a light bulb inside of the enclosure to keep the tarantula warm or something. It's like, if I did that now, I would get roasted. You know, it would be dangerous for the spiders, you know, but so you constantly got to be learning and be open-minded. And there's some people out there that have some pretty wild ideas. Like, you know, like they have this really, someone posted once, they keep their avicularia in an arboreal kind of exoterra enclosure. And instead of a water dish, the bottom is just water. Like they just have the whole thing filled with water. And my initial reaction was like, that's stupid. Why would you do that? But I'm like, it's working for them. So maybe I shouldn't be so judgmental. Like maybe I won't do it, but if it's working, that's the only way we really figure out what works best, is by having an open mind and trying different things and figuring out what's detrimental and what's has a positive impact. So yeah, I mean, I always got to keep learning myself and stay open-minded and adapting and changing and growing, especially talking about this stuff publicly, because it's like, I don't want to be one of those old men that's stuck in their ways and are like, you know, you can't use that substrate because I don't like that. I only use cocoa fiber because that's what I've used for 20 years, you know, like
you can't feed that, stores monitor, crickets. I've been feeding them mice its whole life. You'd be fine. Okay. Your lizard is so fat it can't move. So yeah, you gotta keep yourself mind open, but you also be careful not to judge by an individual situation.
Yeah.
Proofs that you come across all the time, situations that should not have worked. People who managed to keep a green anole in with their rose hair tarantula. People who managed to keep guppies in with those idiot iridescent sharks, in with a red devil, in with a green terror, and somehow nothing bad happens. You got to keep in mind, never judge by one instance, because weird shit happens all the time.
Yeah.
That shouldn't work. Sometimes work.
I was going to say, I think to follow up on what Jay said, a very cool process that we have is our core values, which is all one team, constantly growing in integrity. So even when we have these disagreements in-house, we can sit down like mature adults and talk them over and kind of brainstorm different things, or like do the research just to make sure, you know, we're not, it's all speculation.
Shay, are you sure you're not from the HR department?
I am not.
She could have been, but no. The thing is, our system is set up that way. There's a program called the Entrepreneurial Operating System, EOS, and lots of businesses use it. And the way we use it allows for me and my employees to get our heads together around different issues and solve them without them being confrontational. EOS has really worked for us.
Nice. Now, do you have a hard time finding people that are willing to do that kind of, I mean, I don't know what size of town or city that you all are in. I know
very
that
tiny.
It's very tiny. Like, tiny. How difficult is it to find people that will even be willing to do that kind of work?
Our type of work, not hard at all. There are arachnid hobbyists that are willing to travel a great distance. I travel 40 minutes every day to get here. So getting the people who are interested in our side isn't hard. We're just waiting for HR to get through the hiring process so we get ours. But there are ones that are more challenging, trying to get people for the Roche department. Unfortunately, this media doesn't allow us to share with you the wonderful smell of our Roche rooms. So that can be a challenge, but that's why we go through all the different hiring programs.
Yeah. I get emails all the time, people offering to be interns or, you know, you don't even have to pay me. I would love to come in and just help you feed spiders and clean cages and stuff like that. And I'm like, that would be awesome, but you live in California, so that doesn't help me at all. And when I look for somebody locally, even just for like one job, like, hey, I gotta, like, I'm trying to find studio space so I can move out of my basement into like an actual kind of office space. So I am not working from home, just because sometimes that has its own, you know, myriad of issues that can arise. But just trying to find somebody that will help me package up all the tarantulas and enclosures and move them to a new space. Like, nobody in my town wants to do that. They're like, you couldn't pay me enough to do that. No way.
Well, luckily that's where, when we get in trouble, having a team of 100 is really helpful. Yeah. Right now, our silkworm team is dramatically understaffed, and God, we can never keep up with as many silkworms as the world wants to buy. So we've had 2 to 3 different people from plant team up helping with the silkworms all day long. We don't have to ask for help like you do. We do have the privilege of having a big company to draw on.
Yeah. So if somebody wants to get a job at Josh's Frogs, how do they go about doing that?
Typically, Indeed is the best way to apply. You have your resume, your cover letter. It's going to ask you a series of questions. At that point, you would wait to hear back from HR, and each division kind of has their own questions you'll get asked. Like, I've joked with Jason about, we need to ask, do you have fast reflexes? Because if the spider runs onto you, or an old coworker used to ask, like, if you see a spider in your house, do you kill it? And just to kind of get the feel of how they act around these animals.
Because you're not like a pet shop, you know, like where, you know, Petco would be hiring people that like dogs and cats. I mean, you guys have such a wide variety of different animals. This is a weird question, but I mean, there's so many of you and so many different departments, and some of them are so drastically different. Do you guys do anything together? Like, do you have like parties or company picnics or like a bar everybody goes to after work or something like that? Like, how do you get to know each other and kind of build this team that you're talking about?
Shows are a great way. Austin can, him and I both hit shows all the time. We love to travel with the company. There is a few local places, you know, coworkers will go out. Every Wednesday we have a company-wide meeting, so we all get together. Sometimes it's in person, sometimes it's digitally, but we all try to stay connected.
We just had an awesome picnic where we celebrated being on Incorporated 500's top 500 fastest growing companies for the 5th year in a row, which is apparently very rare. So we had a big old picnic and did all sorts of games. And then just last week for the State of the Quarter, we did a potluck, and everybody brought in some yummy food, and we all got together and ate it. It's a fun place to work. It really is. There's not many places like this.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it. And Austin, I'm going to ask this for you, because you've been there the least amount of time, right?
Yes.
Is that an assumption? Like, so what kind of drew you to even apply and do this kind of work?
So I have, I was keeping tarantulas like by myself, just keeping them on a lower scale. And I've always kind of seen Josh's Frogs because I'm only about 10 minutes away. And I got a mature male avicularia that I ended up selling here. And I just kind of hung out for a minute and talked. And then I met someone that worked here, kind of talked to them for a little bit, established a relationship, began to kind of learn from them a little bit. And then I was brought here by that person and introduced to Jason, who took me under his wing and pretty much taught me everything I need to know about spiders and producing them.
Nice. And how did COVID affect you all as far as a business? I mean, I know you're not really open to the public, so, you know, but as far as like working conditions and stuff like that, like how did you all handle that?
Interestingly enough, we had a very different experience than most of the rest of the nation as far as COVID. When COVID hit, the insect production and insect fulfillment were all together on the same floor. And we'd get a bunch of orders for crickets and roaches and everything else throughout the day. And, you know, the stack would be like an inch, inch and a half thick. COVID hit and 9 inches. That's my hand span. That's how tall the stack of orders was. Nobody could get out, but we could deliver to them. So we actually went nuts for a couple of years. It's finally starting to taper down a little bit. And we're focusing our budgets to make sure that we keep up with that. But yeah, while everybody else was struggling to get by, oh my God, we were doing a lot of business.
We could not keep up.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I guess that does make sense. Since you were predominantly online, I guess all the online businesses were blowing up
like
during that
time. 200 to 300% growth.
Yeah. But was it difficult as far as, you know, just different? I don't know what it was like in your state, but I mean, did they try to shut you down because you have multiple people in one location working or anything like that?
Well, luckily, because we actually provide a number of zoos throughout the country with the feeders they use to feed theirs, we were very early on judged to be a necessary business. So they never shut us down. We were given a special thing that we put in our car so that we could show that we were going to work and that we are an exempt business that was deemed necessary.
Gotcha.
Yeah. We took all the safety protocol as well. We had, you know, we masked up for a while. We kind of keep our 6 foot distance. We still do that just because, you know, we like our space here. Yeah. And we wiped down surfaces. We carried all the safety protocols as well. So we just kind of ran on as it did. Some departments got moved to working at home for a bit, but they're all back in the building. And
now, did you notice that like the pet sales, I mean, not just feeders, but I mean, were people buying more tarantulas during that time? Because I read an article, it was almost more like a hit piece by some scientists that were just showing the amount, like the spike in tarantula sales and other exotic pet sales during the COVID lockdown. I mean, did you all experience anything like that?
We definitely did. And it's not the first time I've actually seen that during a hard time. Back when the housing bubble burst and all of a sudden nobody had any money, I was working at Proust Pets. Our business didn't decline. We actually increased. When times are tough, people want to put their money into something they feel they get more of a reward out of. And getting the newer, bigger television didn't do it as much. But getting these pets that you now have more time with, that did. So yeah, our pet sales went through the roof.
I don't know why they focused mainly on tarantulas in that article, but you know, they were like scraping. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about? That research paper that came out?
No, but again, I'm not surprised to hear it.
The whole kind of concept of the paper was demonstrating the growth in sales of tarantulas during COVID, or leading up to it, and then a spike during the lockdown, and essentially it was like this correlation that they were kind of making, saying that because there was this huge spike in tarantulas that were available for sale online and people buying them and keeping them as pets, that must mean that there are a whole lot more tarantulas being taken out of the wild, and you know, native populations are being decimated, and this industry needs to be regulated. And it was kind of frustrating to read, because it's just like you're totally discounting like all these tarantulas that you're showing available for sale online. I would suggest that the majority of them are captive bred, like they're not being brought out of the wild. I was wondering if you guys had any kind of take on that, but since you haven't read it, I'd probably not, but it was a frustrating article, and it was like all over. I mean, like National Geographic was running articles on it. New York Times, Washington Post. I think, I can't even remember. Wired interviewed me for, like the other side of it, it didn't make it in their magazine, but it was like on their website. And I talked to the guy for 30, 45 minutes, had this really long conversation. and he used one quote. It was like mainly from that. I was like, come on, you gotta give me, it's like 90% about the scientist that wrote the paper, and I get one sentence.
Yeah, my sentence would have been, did he separate his data while caught from Captain Brett?
Yeah, yeah.
That would be my one sentence.
Yep.
That sounds like suspect data.
Yeah. I mean, and they even admit it in the paper when they're talking about it. They're like, we really have no way of differentiating what's Captain Brett and what's wild caught. But based on our experience, we are going to say that probably 80% of them are wild caught. It's like, there's no way. But yeah.
That number smells like poop because they took it out of their butt.
But it also addressed a lot of the controversy of species that are newly discovered, like T. celadonia or the bee, I can never pronounce it, the bee Cygnorhizium, the Borneo, the neon blue tarantula.
Brunipes simoroxygum.
Yeah, that one. Something like that.
Birupes simoroxygorum.
Well, look at that, thank Austin, you. Coming out with the Latin. Beautiful, man.
Austin.
So when, what is Josh's Frog's kind of a moral stance? I mean, you guys seem to be like really focused on the captive breeding and being ethical and stuff like that. So when there are new species that, you know, are discovered or, you know, recently described and, you know, they're in this country that, you know, they don't really have any kind of standing exporting agreement for the pet trade. And then all of a sudden they're popping up in Europe and then they make their way to the United States. Like, do you guys stay away from species like that? Or, I mean,
I was there when things first blew up, when the first Celadonias got snatched, and then Fish and Wildlife were at first saying that they were going to, that nothing that is endemic to Brazil is legal, because Brazil has never legally allowed any spiders to export ever. So anything that's endemic is descended from wild-caught animals that were collected illegally. So we were in a little bit of a, because we want to make sure that we're absolutely legal. We're an above-the-board, open books, transparent company. So that was, and we tried to communicate with Fish and Wildlife Services to get some clarity, along with, you know, the entire rest of our hobby, and they absolutely refused. The problem is Brazil needs to get out of its own butt and start controlling their exports, because there's animals being exported from Brazil right now, and they are not legal to be exported. None of them are. All of our endemics, the Brazilian giant white knee, so many common spiders to our hobby, those came from illegally collected animals. And not because somebody was trying to be shady, but because Brazil won't answer questions. And then they got to come behind after the fact and say, well, we've never allowed legal exportation of any of our spiders. And that's because you never did anything about it.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything more wrong with a Celadonia than a Giroldi, which is one of the only other spiders that they seized a shipment of. It's just that because there is no policy being set down, it's being done by whoever can get it done. And it's all underboard. It should be overboard. It should be done legally.
Yeah, I agree. There was a video somebody shared with me recently, like 2 days ago, maybe yes. I don't think it was yesterday, but it was very recent. And it was somebody that lives in Brazil trying to elicit customers from America for these species that aren't even in the hobby. These endemic Brazilian species, and showing video evidence that they can safely package these things. And I think it was like inside of a computer and mail it. And, you know, it was frustrating, because it's like, that's one guy in Brazil trying to convince Americans to buy, and it's making the entire hobby look bad. And inevitably there's going to be one idiot that's going to be like, ooh, I'll take you up on that offer, you know? And it just takes one person doing something stupid like that, getting busted, that kind of taints the whole hobby is bad or illegal, or, you know, doing things like that. So as a business that doesn't just deal in tarantulas, I mean, you guys have all kinds of different animals from all over the world. Like, how do you combat that kind of negative stereotype and avoid those situations? Do you have like policies in place of, you know, species?
I've been very careful and very thought out. Like, we thought over the course of a month to figure out, we pulled all of our Brazilian endemic species off so that we could talk about where we're going with this. We have people who are degree professionals who know all about the various certifications and things that you need to be able to get these animals and keep these animals. So just being open, being transparent, and showing that there is an alternative, and that's legal captive bred animals.
And kind of piggybacking on that, how do you, as a department that's breeding tarantulas and really focus on captive breeding and making sure that everything's done in that manner, how do you decide which species you're going to work with and which ones you're not? Like, is it based on like what you like, what you think other people would like? Is it like a marketing decision? Do you have like research showing what are the best sellers, what aren't selling well? I mean, how do you make the decisions on what you're breeding?
Well, I personally, you heard me say it in the beginning, my favorite is Zenesis. So I try and focus around the larger New World terrestrials like Zenesis, Pamphlebatius. For me, it really just comes down to what I like.
I think it's a bit of both. We always discuss, like, you know, what do we think would be a good seller? You know, what do we want to work with? Is there a certain species that could use getting captive bred more than others? Like, is there some that have dwindling populations that we would really like to get back in the like good numbers? Sometimes it is just newer, cool stuff. Like, we have some Vietnam silvers. We have some Haplopus gorillas. We have some really cool stuff in as well. But I think in the long run, it's about, you know, getting the species in that could actually use the reboot, that are kind of getting overcaught or just dying off.
I guess what I was hoping for was that there was market research being done, that you had somebody on your team.
Market research pretty much comes down to the 20 plus years that I've been in the hobby and selling at Prusa's and seeing how people react to different spiders and how to try to market different spiders so that people who will appreciate them will pick them up.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the most data oriented we have is my experience in seeing what has sold for me at what prices and what got quick response, what got negative response, what needed a little bit more information to get the response that we're looking for. But that's the extent of it at the moment. But now that we are recording everything that we do here, mm-hmm. because we're also scientifically as well as monetarily motivated. And our goal is to be looking over in the future as we have more data to see not just, you know, what spiders sold the most, but like it's more tiered than that. Like, when I've got these five A-list species in stock, those may not go up in sale, but you may find that some of your less expensive species go up as people are coming to see your $300 spiderlings, but they're buying your $40 to $80 spiderlings. So it's how well are these selling when I've got these other species in stock?
A discussion I've had with other breeders and stuff in the past, like trying to find that balance between breeding and carrying or offering for sale tarantulas that are popular that people are going to want to buy, but also doing like sometimes they're breeding at a loss. They're breeding a species that maybe people aren't interested in. They're not buying right now. They're not selling for a good price, but they're doing it to continue that bloodline, or you know what I mean? To keep them in the hobby. Because like, I mean, Rosehair is a perfect example. When I first started getting, you know, into tarantulas, that was pretty much the only tarantula you could find. Like every pet store had a shelf, like, you know, a whole shelf with like a couple dozen of them available for sale. And then, you know, I think it was even recently I've had some people that are like, I would love to have a rose hair, but I can't find anybody that's got any for sale. And it's like, how is that possible that something could be same thing kind of happened with curly hairs for a little while. And, you know, there's a lot of species that you know, they become so maybe oversaturated or something. People aren't buying them. So people are not breeding them. And then they just kind of disappear or they become extremely rare. So, I mean, do you guys take that into consideration when you're deciding what to breed, or is it mainly just what's available?
Absolutely. We've seen it in several different species, not just in spiders. There are times when the Dendrobates leucomelus were so overbred, because that's the one that everybody had, that the going prices went so low that nobody was willing to produce them, that produced them in any numbers. Mm-hmm. Then 5 years later, you couldn't find leucomelus anywhere and the price went through the roof. So yeah, we definitely do keep things about that in our mind. We've still got Epipedibates, Fantasticus, and Trivetatus that, you know, they went from popular to too cheap that nobody would bother. And now they're insanely expensive. So That pendulum swings back and forth and can be rewarding as long as you jump on it at the right time.
I'd say a personal example that we've had is at one point we had about 2,000 baby girly hairs. And so we had to move those. And now we don't have as many, but we've talked about, do we breed them again? Because in so many years from now, how many of those are still going to be in the hobby? How many of those are still going to be alive? Do we still need to supply that? So those conversations do get taken into consideration.
Yeah. So do you guys, you breed a tarantula and you say, just theoretically, we're speaking here or hypothetically, you've got 100 spiderlings. Do you keep a certain percentage of them like as breeding stock? Like, you know, it'll take this tarantula 10 years before it's matured to breed, but we're going to take care of it for, however many years, just so we know we've got this. Or do you just sell all the spiderlings that you have?
Depends on the species.
Yeah.
I don't think we get too dedicated in the 8 to 10 year range of maturity, but if 2, 3, 4 years, those are species we're more open to talking about, like, okay, yeah, we should hold some of these back and raise them up for our own breeder stock.
But currently we are doing that. Absolutely. And we're focusing on the ones that are going to be fast growing enough that I can get them to mature and breedable within the next 3 to 5 years, as opposed to like the ones that are closer to 8 to 10, but those are on my list. But first, I got to prove myself with the 3 to 5s.
Yeah, I'm looking at your website right now, just the tarantula section. And one thing that I really like that I wish a lot more dealers would do is the photos that you use. I mean, you're selling spiderlings and you're showing pictures of spiderlings, which I think is very cool. Is that like was that an intentional thing that you're like, we need to show people exactly what they're getting? Or is it just that's what pictures you had available?
It's a mix of both. We would love to show people exactly what they get, but we would also love to display them as adults. One of our current projects is getting some better pictures on the website. Some are a little blurry, people taking pictures of spiders get a little jumpy and, come back. So I've actually recently taken over the pictures and I'm just using my phone, but yeah. Some of the newer species that we launched, like the Victoria that's now on our website, I did all the pictures for those myself. I sent them off to marketing. They edited it and now it's up.
Just that I'd like to add that we specifically put the spiderling picture on the page of the site that shows all the different species. So people going into it knowing I'm getting a spiderling. And then they'll see pictures of what it's going to grow up into and other pictures as well. But yes, you were absolutely right. We thought it was very important to know for people to know what they're getting.
Yeah.
Even go so far as to put the size of the spider rounded down in the name of the spider. So like somebody wants to buy a pumpkin patch because they're so excited. They saw an adult female online, probably eating its male. And they want one so bad and they order one and they don't realize that what's coming to them is an eighth of an inch.
Yeah.
That it's got a fair fight with a fruit fly.
Yeah. I see that a lot, even with dealers that I'm friends with and I really appreciate what they do. You go to their website and they're selling quarter inch spiderlings, but all the photos are of full grown mature females. And it's like, it's not misleading, but I mean, you're saying right there in the title, this is a spiderling, this is its size, but you're not giving a good representation to possibly a new keeper of what exactly they're getting, So, I mean, sometimes the spiderlings they're just a little tiny brown spider, not this beautiful black, orange, and red thing that you're expecting. And it seems to turn a lot of people off. But that was one of the first things I noticed checking out your all's website was like, I like that. I like that they have the spiderling photos up there as well.
We're currently working on updating all of our description as well, just to make sure everything is up-to-date information. I actually made our templates. And so if you go through on any of our new species and soon to be all of the species, they will all be uniform. And there's a section that says color/pattern. And it's like as a spiderling, they're described what they look like. And then as they mature, they could, like if it's a Versi color, there'd be 3 stages, but otherwise just what they look like as a baby versus adult. So people know what they're getting. We don't want to lead them on like, oh, it's going to have its adult colors right when you get it.
Yeah.
It'll be a brown spider for a while.
We are hitting that 2-hour mark. Was there anything you guys wanted to say before we get off of here? Any last thoughts or?
I mean, thanks so much for having us on. It was fun talking to you and hopefully we can work together again in the future.
In case you decide to throw it in there somewhere, because it would make my kids' day, but you don't have to. But Edith Boget says hi, and then you are awesome.
Well, thank you,
Edith. They actually listen to you sometimes over my own advice.
You should probably listen to your dad. I think he probably has more knowledge than me, but that is awesome. So hello, Edith. Edith, right? Did I say that
Edith,
right?
Yep.
Okay. Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah,
thank you, Richard.
And your dad's a cool guy. Yeah, don't give him a hard time. Well, this has been a lot of fun.
Find yourself in Owosso. Seriously, we would love to give you a tour of this place. And, you know, the tarantulas are great. Don't get me wrong. But, oh, my God. I just took Edith here about 3 weeks ago on a tour on Saturday, so there wouldn't be anyone else here.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I've been in this hobby for like 30 years. And, oh, my God, every time I went into a new room, I was finding stuff that I didn't even know we had that was just cooler than I ever thought.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever find myself in that town, but I may have to make a special trip to come out and visit you guys. Thank you guys so much for being willing to come on and talk and share your experiences. I hope I didn't dig too deep, but it was fascinating. It was really kind of cool getting a peek behind the curtain and seeing what you guys are doing. So Shay and Austin and Jason, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for allowing us.
Super fun talking with you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for doing what you do. We really appreciated it.
Well, thank you so much. And be sure to tell your daughter, Edith, I said hello.
I definitely will. They're going to wait. As soon as I get through the door, the first thing they're going to say. So now I can say with pride, Richard said hi back.
Heck yeah. I'll have to send him some stickers.
They're not going to believe that part, but that you specifically said to listen to me and not give me a hard time.
I'll make sure to include that part in the podcast. So they were coming straight from my mouth.
I will hold you to it. That would be awesome.
Well, guys, it's been great. Shay, it's nice to actually meet you in person now. We've been emailing back and forth so much.
It was good to actually talk with you.
Yeah. Everything's cool. We're all kosher.
Oh, yeah. We're great.
Awesome. Oh, you guys are awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you all for listening. Be sure to check out Josh's Frog's website. They got a whole, and I was just looking at it. They've got a whole lot of different species of tarantulas on there. So you won't be disappointed. And you can tell by the conversation, they know what they're doing. They care about these spiders and you're going to get some healthy slings. So definitely check them out. And you got a sale going on right now. I think I saw some kind of Halloween.
Days of Halloween.
Yeah.
Check out our website.
Yeah. So yeah, save a little bit of money and yeah. All right. So be sure you leave a review down below, hit the like button, follow all that fun stuff. And we will see you in the next episode. Goodbye.